Shrink Wrap Radio number 533, a psychoanalyst's take on cybertherapy with Dr. Jillian Isaacs Russell.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with UK-trained psychoanalyst and psychotherapist Dr. Jillian Isaacs Russell about her book, Screen Relations: The Limits of Computer-Mediated Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy. For more information about Dr. Jillian Isaacs Russell, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Once again, today's episode is sponsored by Swellbee.com, a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to manage and market their practice. Free and easy to use, sign up today at Swellbee.com. Now, here is the interview. Dr. Jillian Isaacs Russell, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and
Here and there, yes. Well, I'm really pleased to have you on the show, I must say. Your 2015 book makes a strong case that there are important differences between computer-mediated therapy versus being face-to-face in the same room. And I should point out that you're a longtime psychoanalyst and not a Luddite.
Correct.
In as much as you've used computers for years and you were a Skype user before you began exploring the topic of your book, but you've become acutely aware that there are significant differences between what you call screen relations, such as we're having now, and face-to-face contact during psychotherapy, which you refer to as co-presence, what we have right now.
Yes.
Well, I think you've raised some really important concerns in your book. I think you've done a real service to the profession by thinking about it more deeply than I think many other people have thought about it. I think many of us have an image of psychoanalysis as being a very conservative practice, so it was a little bit surprising to me, maybe because of my own history, that a psychoanalyst would be exploring cybertherapy. So I'll give you a chance to react to that.
Well, in fact, perhaps some psychoanalysts are conservative in their practice if you consider conservatism to be people who work with relationships and largely work in the same environment and feel that the way that people relate to each other is what they're concerned with, and the transformation of a patient is through the relationship. I suppose that could be considered conservative. However, psychoanalysts, like I think all clinicians, probably quite some time ago, started using the telephone in the 50s. Yeah. You know, to fill in for absences, ill patients, ways of maintaining continuity. And it was something that no one spoke about. You weren't really supposed to do it, but many people did. And eventually some articles and papers were written about the telephone. And because psychoanalysts are part of the wider culture, I think that when communication via technology began, for one reason or another, psychoanalysts, like other clinicians, began to learn to use such platforms as Skype in order to do the same thing.
I think that's the key point, actually. That reaction on my part was rooted in my graduate school experience. I went to a very psychoanalytic, maybe one of the last of the psychoanalytic-oriented PhD programs in the U.S., which was the University of Michigan, a long time ago. And those psychoanalysts at the time, I kind of rebelled against a lot of that because I found it very conservative, paternalistic in some ways, and I've kind of gotten over that to a large extent. But see, there's this little holdover when I think, oh my goodness, that's surprising. But the key point really is that, hey, there are people like the rest of us. And as the culture has changed and more gone online, of course, psychoanalysts have come along. And one of the things that you say in your book was that there, I think you say something along the lines of there's been a paucity of research in this area. But I was impressed by the number of citations in your book that actually reveal that some people have been thinking deeply about these issues for some time. And you really, really bring that into the fore. Actually, you report that a large number of psychoanalysts and other psychotherapists have been quick, maybe too quick, to jump onto the distance therapy bandwagon. So tell us about that.
Well, as was I. I say that because of my own experience. In 2008, I ran down and closed a 30-year psychoanalytic practice in the UK and moved to a very remote part of the Black Hills of South Dakota.
Wow, what a change.
And it was an enormous change. And in order to really bridge the gap, both literal and figurative, I began to experiment with using Skype simply to connect with family and friends. And then some supervisees and past patients who didn't actually realize that I had left the country requested to meet with me. And so I was really enthusiastic to use technology.
Sure.
I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I simply thought that having myself and the computer as two instruments meant that I didn't have to worry about a consulting room, being in the same room with patients, being able to meet with colleagues. And so I was extremely enthusiastic to start this endeavor. And as I say in the book, I felt that strongly that I was sleepwalking into this. I didn't question the there was going to be any difference in the experience at all.
So. Yeah, I can really relate to that. I'm sort of a enthusiast myself about, I tend to get enthusiastic, I'm realizing, about a lot of things. But as time goes by, some kind of more critical evaluation begins to creep in. And I myself have been a technophile by reflex from an early age. But as time has gone on, I've become increasingly aware of the shadow aspects of technology, which are many and broader than what we're going to be talking about today. There are a number of terms out there that are being used for computer-mediated psychotherapy, and the term you're using is screen relations. Mm-hmm. How did you come to use that term, and what is it meant to convey?
Screen relations are human interactions mediated through communications technology. And in fact, that term was coined by my wonderful friend and colleague, Todd Essig, who was one of the first and only psychoanalysts to be doing a lot of thinking about what it meant to be communicating through technology quite early on. And when I started my research, I had looked and looked for papers and research on this subject. He was one of the only one.
Oh, okay.
So I contacted him again via technology, and we've had a wonderful correspondence, and I had the good fortune to meet him finally a couple of years into my research, and we meet up and share panels and various speaking engagements.
Yeah, I'd like to actually show a copy of your book for the people who will be watching this on video. It's Screen Relations, The Limits of Computer-Mediated Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy. And in fact, he wrote the, I guess, the introduction.
The foreword, yes.
The foreword, which was, he did a fine job of that. And then you cite him really throughout the book. There are a number of times when you quote him. So he really is a pioneering presence in terms of thinking about this. Yeah. Now, interestingly, you became involved with, with the China-American Psychoanalytic Alliance. And I think I recall reading something about that, and I think it was the New Yorker magazine, one of my most important journals, very influential. And I must admit, I was fairly shocked at the time to discover that such a serious undertaking as psychoanalysis was being attempted at such a great, not only geographical distance, but cultural distance. And you kind of became involved with that project. Maybe you can tell us a bit about that experiment.
Yes. Becoming involved was another way of continuing to be involved with psychoanalysis whilst living in the backwoods. And I discovered an article on CAPA, the China-American Psychoanalytic Alliance, and asked them whether I could become involved. What it is a nonprofit organization that responded to requests from Chinese mental health professionals for training and for experience with psychodynamic or psychoanalytic psychotherapy. So not in terms of the training that CAPA does, it's not a psychoanalytic training per se, but a psychoanalytic psychotherapy training.
Okay.
What they did was involve practitioners all over the West, not only in the United States, but in Europe, Israel, South America, both teaching and supervising and also doing training therapies so that the students who are very sophisticated professionals can learn something about a psychoanalytic approach to treatment. And I became very involved and taught many classes and did many years of supervision and also some treatments.
And a lot of that was on Skype, right?
All of it was on Skype,
yeah.
I made one trip to China, a wonderful trip, in 2010 and met people that I had supervised and taught, and it was a thrilling experience.
Now, but as a little bit of a sidetrack here, I'm thinking that psychodynamic psychotherapy might be very against political doctrine in China. And is that an issue?
Well, I think that by the time that people were getting really interested in the subject, that things had really loosened up and become much more forward-thinking in China. Mm-hmm. This was, I think, the first treatment was done online in 2005 or 2006. And, of course, now China is absolutely booming. And yeah. I think that it's no coincidence that mental health professionals in China have become very interested in a one-to-one treatment that thinks about individuality.
Okay.
And so yes, it was a thing that was ripe, and it was something that people actually asked to know about.
Okay. Now, in your work with that through that organization using Skype, You began to be aware of that it really didn't feel the same as being in the same room with the people that you were speaking to. And so you began to interview your colleagues and some of their patients very closely because their initial reaction was, oh, it's definitely the same. That was kind of the initial response that people were having. But you began to question it more closely. What sorts of reports did you get? Tell us about that.
The way it developed was when I began to do this work, I joined with several peers across the country, most more on the East Coast, and we met monthly for peer group supervision. And we thought that we were going to mainly be discussing the cultural differences and how to bridge that, how to think about that.
Right.
But what we found was that what we were discussing more and more were the technological impacts on the actual treatments. And so that's what got me thinking about it. We had been told before we started that the experience of treating someone via technology at a distance was absolutely identical to treating someone in the room, that the transference formed as it normally would, that the to and fro in the actual relationship was the same. And also, we weren't warned at all about what it meant to use technology. We were told that it was crystal clear in the way that the communication was. So when we actually started doing it, what we found was we were dealing with all sorts of things, from terrible interruptions and disruptions to...
With Skype going out...
Yeah, absolutely. Poor connections. But then we began to talk about our own experience of being in our room and the patient being in his or her room thousands of miles away. And one thing that we began to discover was that we had very uncharacteristic memory lapses, that both there was a forgetting of scheduled sessions. So people who were professionals who had worked for years, very senior clinicians, would literally forget that they had scheduled a session. And also memory lapses in the session itself. So the people who were accustomed to never taking notes found that they had to take often copious notes in order to remember what was going on in the session. That was one of the dawning differences.
Why do you think that was? It seems curious. In your book, you actually do speculate about that, going into neuroscience and other areas. What's your capsule sense of why the memory would be so poor?
Right. Well, one of the things that doesn't happen much when you're using screen relations is movement. You aren't going to move into your consulting room. You're not going to move to greet someone, to bring them into your consulting room. They're not going to be traveling to come to the session. They're not going to leave the session. And so all that's happening is this quite restricted sitting in one place and using a finger. And there's been various bits of research. Firstly, that... things as simple as using handwriting something rather than using keys, makes you remember something much better, because accompanying movement with an actual cognitive procedure reinforces it in the memory. And then in 2014, the Nobel Prize winners for physiology and medicine did a fascinating study in which they discovered that the same neurons that were in charge of navigation, so you're knowing how you get from one place to another, and would make neural maps in your brain, they were the same neurons that were responsible for memory. My speculation is that possibly if you're not moving, you're not actually overlaying things as strongly in memory as you would if you had some movement around your activity.
Yeah, that was a fascinating finding. And also your mention, your example that you mentioned in the book of handwriting, I felt terribly guilty and chastened, because I'm a keyboard person going way, way back to typewriters. And so my handwriting is terrible. It always has been. But I'm wondering, well, geez, maybe I need to be doing handwriting, because memory certainly is an issue for me in many areas of my life.
Well, or you could be walking and doing something as well. I think there are all different kinds of movement things.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the issue of location, of like you know, going to the door and letting the client in and so on. And there are a lot of issues that came up in your study relating to the therapist's location, the client's location. Maybe we could go into that a little bit.
Yes. Well, when I've interviewed hundreds of people now, hundreds of clinicians, and fewer patients because obviously patients are less available. But what came up again and again was that people worked from everywhere. Patients worked from pool sides, from cars where they're driving and have Bluetooth, from work, from bedrooms, under bedclothes frequently, from all sorts of places. And in fact, the clinicians do too, because of time differences. So you end up not in your consulting room, but in your home office. People work from hotels when they're on conferences. And so I think the first thing that came up was that people worked from many different locations and often not the same ones. And in the times when I was beginning to interview, it didn't occur to people that that was a key and important issue, even though in our training it's emphasized that not only do, of course, we work from the same location, but we pretty much keep the setting the same around us. And if there are big changes, they tend to be a big issue in the therapy itself. So when you have this constant shifting, there's a tremendous sense of unreliability, and the patient is not being held in a safe and secure environment. And of course, a huge departure from traditional practice is that the analyst is not providing that environment for the patient. Which has been absolutely a key thing.
Yeah, and I would think that it would tend to, it sounds like the level of commitment, of emotional commitment, is somehow lessened in that process, that I can talk to you from the hotel, I can talk to you from any of a variety of places that are always changing, whether both for the client and for the therapist. And so... Mm-hmm.
You would think, I think that people might look at that as that they have a high level of commitment in that if you're at a conference and you continue to see your patient, then you're very committed to them. But in fact, it is a kind of paradoxical thing because, of course, whereas the ease of connection is emphasized, the lack of continuity is also something that occurs. You know, one of the things that Winnicott and Ballant and many, many other analysts emphasized was the provision of a safe and secure space for the patient. And when one is simply not providing that at all, it has a huge impact on the relationship between the patient and the analyst. Many of our patients present to us because they have had huge impingements, damaging impingements in their lives, and yet we expect them to provide a space where there are no impingements, where they can provide a safe space, which is quite impossible for many, many people. But that's why they're seeing us. I'll tell you a story. One person that I interviewed was seeing a mental health professional in a country, I think it was an African country, where there were no English-speaking therapists, psychoanalysts. And the mental health professional, was meeting via Skype. And the analyst that I interviewed said that her laptop broke. And she was in the back of beyond, and it was going to take a long time for her laptop to be fixed. And so she arranged to borrow the computer of a colleague quite a distance away and went to that colleague's house and started the session in the colleague's living room. And as the session started, the analyst noticed that a man walked into the picture behind the patient, and she mm-hmm. mentioned it, and the patient realized that the husband of her colleague was in the room, felt very uncomfortable, didn't really feel like she could throw him out of his own living room, so she picked up the laptop and went out to the patio. She went out to the patio, and on the patio, she continued the session, and more family members came out. And at that point, the analyst said, "Do you want to stop this session? And perhaps we can reconvene at another time when you can have more privacy." Well, the patient was very, very desperate to have the support to do the work that she needed to do. So what did she do? She got up with the laptop, and there was a broom cupboard off of the patio. She went into this tiny, sweltering space. She sat down, shut the door, and finished the session surrounded by mops and brooms. And, you know, I think this story is very touching in terms of her determination to finish the session. But also, it really tells us about the inability for many patients to actually be able to provide a continuity and a safe space for themselves. And her analyst was not able to do that because, of course, they were in two different places.
Yeah. And synchronistically, we just had an experience of what can happen when the environment's not controlled, right? You had a phone call come in or something. I heard something like that.
So I don't even know how to stop that, actually. If I knew it, I would.
It may happen again, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so there often is, there can be an impact of the absence of a shared space.
Yes.
And there actually another concept that you talk about, this would maybe be a good place to go into that, is the notion of presence.
Yes.
And presence is important in the psychoanalytic approach. And it's more than just being in the same room, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, about that.
It's important in the psychoanalytic approach, but my thoughts about presence and what I discovered about presence, I actually discovered through researchers in informatics. So that's about computer human interaction, technological interaction, and they are very keen to define presence, because what they're trying to do is to reproduce the experience of presence in a mediated setting, in a technologically mediated setting. So for them, presence is not the same thing as emotional engagement or absorption or your degree of technological immersion even. For the researchers in informatics, presence is a core neuropsychological phenomenon. And a sense of presence comes from an organism's capacity to locate itself in the external world according to the action it can do in the external world. And particularly for humans, these actions specifically include the person's capacity to interact with an other in a shared external environment. So being in an external shareable world, not an internal thought experiment. So the sense of presence enables the nervous system, and this is for all organisms, not just human beings, to recognize that it's in an environment outside itself, and it's not just the product of one's inner world, for instance, that you're awake and you're not dreaming. And it's this experience of presence that is very difficult, actually well nigh impossible, to reproduce through technological mediation. There, you can have brief moments of it, but it isn't a consistent experience. And this is something that is explored and defined by informatics researchers, not by psychoanalysts. And they say that it has not been achieved, the sense, a continuous sense of presence via mediation. Mm-hmm. Of course, what we're doing here on a two-dimensional screen is a perfect example of that. You know, how present do we feel together when we're actually communicating in two dimensions?
Right. And in fact, there are cues that would be missing, such as olfactory cues and other sort of subtle things.
Well, right? 60% of our communication is nonverbal, more than 60%. Mm-hmm. And we're only seeing the upper bits of ourselves, and we are not seeing each other in three dimensions, and we're not picking up instantaneous, moment-to-moment, nonverbal, implicit communication, which is absolutely vital for communication from the time we're born to all through our lives, and also considered central to what goes on in the consulting room as well. That enormous bit of communication is not going to happen in the same way online.
Yeah, you gave an example that I was struck by of a analyst, I believe, who's blind.
Yes.
And who found that being online with someone, even though she was not, you know, can't see them on Skype, there was a real difference for her, even though it was all audio, whether in person or, well, not all, actually, whether it was she was in person with somebody or it was online, there was a difference that she sensed that it felt very different to her experientially.
Her name is Maria Solano, and she is an analyst in training in New York. Mm-hmm. And so she herself is in analysis as well as treating patients. And she was very, very clear to me during the interview that experiencing her patients and her analyst in the same room co-presently had a very different quality to her than communicating with people via Skype, but audio or on the telephone. And I think that what she's getting at is this experience of embodiment. And the experience of embodiment, both our own and of the other person in a shared environment, is a central aspect to our experience of being. So feeling present, being there in the physical world, is grounded in perception, action, and body. You can't get away from that.
Yeah. In fact, you use the word simulation for the screen relation, which is interesting. That in what ways is this a simulation rather mm-hmm. than, quotes, the real thing?
Right. Well, evolution prepared us to be embodied beings at sharing the same space when we communicate and when we relate. So all screen relations are simulations of that experience. Now, that is not necessarily a derogatory word. It's just simply noting that there is a difference between the way that we actually communicate and relate when we do it the way we've been evolved to do it and the way that it is done via technology. And I suppose you could use the example of a flight simulator. You know, it's very interesting for training, and it can help a pilot to learn various things about flying. But it is a simulation of when you actually are up there mm-hmm. and flying.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another topic that you touched on was dressing for the part. Tell us about that. What are you getting at there?
Well, many, many analysts that I interviewed said things like they wore a business suit or a formal top and their pajamas on the bottom.
Yeah.
Right. Or slippers or whatever. I hasten to say that I am not doing that today.
Okay. I am not either, but I have at times.
Right. And the question is more why. I mean, this is something that newscasters do as well. You know, a lot of times they'll have their formal top and because you don't see what's below the desk. What is it that makes us so tempted to kind of dress down in a bit of us that isn't visible? so that you're actually communicating with your patient looking like you are this formal person at work, thinking in a way that is professional, but that there's another sort of transgressive bit of you below that no one can see that's wearing slippers and pajamas.
Uh-huh. Okay. I would imagine that that could lead to all sorts of disruptive projections and imaginations on the part of the client, of the therapy client, you know, of their fantasies about the therapist, whether or not they're dressed below or not.
Well, I think that that the lack of information goes both ways. One analyst I interviewed saw a patient 5 days a week for 2 or 3 years before she realized that the patient was just wearing underwear on the bottom half of her. And of course, that's hugely significant, but it was not something that she could detect until the patient was ready to, I guess, let her know about it.
It makes me wonder, again, I mentioned this before, if there's the same level of emotional investment or commitment to the process as when physically present, for both sides.
Yes. I mean, I think it's different because you aren't in the same room. And so your own experience of your environment is very different. You can't see the rest of my consulting room. So for all you know, there's just a bookcase and, I don't know, there's exercise equipment in the corner. And I think that this makes a difference for the practitioner as well. It's, you know, what are you projecting to the patient? Are you an authentic person having an authentic experience? Or are you somehow play acting? And you were asking about dressing for the part. There were many analysts who talked to me about, mainly female analysts, who talked to me about putting extra makeup on because they looked different on screen. You're aware of the way you look. Well, as I'm talking to you now, I can see a small picture of myself. At some platforms allow you to click on it and make it disappear. But most people have an experience of what they look like, which is a different sort of consciousness, isn't it, than
yes.
just going forth and interacting with someone.
Right, right, yeah. And sometimes some people might be very critical of how they look, you know, and be distracted by that.
Yes.
Although most of us get over that pretty quickly. You know, you went in your research, you went beyond the conversations with therapists and clients, and you ventured into other areas and disciplines beyond psychoanalysis into neuroscience, communication studies, infant observation, cognitive science, and human-computer interaction. And you've alluded to a bit of that as we've been going along here. And you kind of alluded to some of the examples you gave come out of attachment theory, mm-hmm. which I think has really come into the fore lately. And the neuroscience and attachment theory are supporting each other in really beautiful and interesting ways.
Yes, and one of the main issues, the one thing that we don't provide is what Bowlby would have called a secure base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the patient is going to feel any security, it's going to be because they're providing it. And that is not, I think, what we're aiming to do when we are giving a treatment.
Yes, in attachment theory, it's said that the patient needs to feel contained and safe, and that's part of the sort of reparenting process, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that that is not something we can provide when you're working from two different locations. Mm-hmm. And so the patient simply doesn't have that experience. I think you can go one step further in that, in terms of that there is no potentiality when you're working screen to screen, meaning that a patient gave me a wonderful statement about this. She said that there's no potential to kiss or kick. And I think what she meant by that is that even if you don't act it out, you know when you are co-present that there's a risk, that there's something about the possibility of you being very angry with your analyst or very much in love with your analyst, and that it's something that can be contained safely within the room and thought about. And when you work screen to screen, that's never tested. You're never able to bridge that distance to actually allow the patient to have an experience of having intense fantasies in the room, expressions of intense feeling, and for the analyst to survive that, to keep on going, to keep on being, to be able to process that without being destroyed.
Are we talking about transference issues here? Are transference issues impacted in your view? I know some of the people that you interviewed said, no, the transference is just as if we were present with one another.
I think that a transference, of course, develops. A transference begins to develop the moment your patient gives you a call on the telephone to make their first appointment, or if they see you on something in America like Psychology Today and they see your picture, that the transference begins to develop. So it's not that there isn't a transference, but I think that as one of the analysts I interviewed said, you hit a wall. There's only so far you can go in the development of the relationship if you're in two different places. There are various bits of a relationship that can't be tested out. One patient said to me that how important, he worked both co-presently and because he traveled for work, he sometimes used technological mediation as well. And he said it was so important for him to be in the same room with his analyst to see that his analyst could actually tolerate his feelings, that his analyst didn't flinch or withdraw or reject him. And I think that when you're on a screen, that's part of the protection. And in fact, an analyst said to me that he very much liked working on the screen because he had very strong counter-transference reactions, and that working on the screen helped him to mute that. Mm-hmm. This is extremely significant, considering that we use ourselves as tuning forks in a way. That's how we work.
So you point out that there's an ironic disjunction of patients seeking greater aliveness, that's what brings them into therapy, and a therapy that's mediated through the screen. These two are sort of, they don't match up.
Well, I think that's true. If you think about the issue of presence and the true feeling of being, of being in the room and having a sense of vitality, I think that working screen to screen diminishes that. Mm-hmm. It is something that people are thinking about in the larger general culture as well. What does it mean that we're exerting so much control on our relationships that they are bounded by the sort of editing power of Facebook or of using mobile phones, texting, that kind of thing.
Yes, yes. You point out that therapy needs to be more than mind to mind, that this technology where it tends to be mind to mind, but you say, as you said earlier, that it needs to be more embodied in order to be truly life-changing.
I think that's true. I think that what happens when you work with technology for communication is that often things get reduced to the verbal, to the explicit, and they also become much more concrete. And so it becomes much more mind-to-mind communication. And of course, the way that we actually relate is embodied. And so it's a state of being rather than just thinking, a state of thinking. And this goes along with the recent neurological findings, thinkings about how we're not Cartesian, the mind and body are not separated, but that we are of a piece, and that our emotions and what we think, what we feel, even our language is informed by our bodies and the limitations of our bodies.
You know, one of the things that comes to mind at times when I'm feeling a little down, a little depressed or whatever, I don't go on Facebook. I don't reach out to people via this modality. There's something that's not satisfying about it when the chips are down.
In fact, there's some research that was done with geriatric patients, and showing that for dealing with loneliness and depression, I think one would quite expect this, but that the only thing that really was effective was a face-to-face interaction, mm-hmm. and that other substitute interactions were not effective.
I found myself thinking about dogs and the difference between seeing a dog on screen and being in the room with a dog. That's absolutely a very different experience, right?
Yes, very much so. And actually, I think dogs probably feel that way too.
Yeah, they get bored very quickly with the screen.
Yeah, they do, because there's nothing sensory there.
Yeah.
So they may see the motion, but, you know, they don't smell anything. They don't feel anything.
Yeah, yeah. What about the issue of the gaze? That's something we need to touch on, too. In these video interviews that I conduct with people like you, and I'm frustrated by the fact that my natural inclination is to look at you when you're talking, except the camera's over here, up here, and the image I see is down a bit and to the left. And so it looks like I'm not looking at you.
Yeah.
When my experience is, I'm looking at you, but your experience is not, he's looking at me, it's he's looking away.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's a real issue here.
It's a huge issue. They are, I believe, working on, I think they may have perfected a very clunky, big technology where you can at least have the feeling that your eyes are meeting.
There is a software that's in another interviewee brought this to my attention. There's software being developed, and I went to the site of the company that's offering it. It's too expensive for me as a podcaster.
Sure.
They want to charge. It's a licensing thing, and it's not terribly inexpensive. So and it's not out yet, so we don't even know how well it will work.
That's true, and we don't, but you're right about the eye contact, because our eye contact from the earliest age between mother and infant is a way of gauging emotional states.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen various research done with people who have damage to parts of their brain that allow them to have eye contact. And it evidently impacts their sense of empathy and their ability to understand what someone else is feeling. And so if we have no eye contact, then we are limiting ourselves in some way. And even I'm wondering if we can produce a sort of virtual eye contact through bells and whistles and mirrors, whether it's going to act in the same way. Mm. I mean, right now, maybe it looks like I'm having eye contact with you, but in fact, what I'm doing is looking at the little green light of the camera.
Right.
I can't see you at all.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Same here. Hmm. And I've wondered if there would be a way with mirrors
they've done that.
Or if I got an external camera and I put it, you know, right, but then I wouldn't be able to, you know, it's a issue. I'm glad people are working on it, I guess. Interestingly, though, and I think this is relevant to the topic, is my experience in interviewing people is sometimes there are moments, at least, of a real sense of rapport.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that keeps me going with this, is like, oh, wow, I had a really good contact with that person. So it can happen.
Yes.
And you're not, you know, we should mention that that you're not altogether against distance therapy.
No. Really, my plea in the book is that we understand the differences between being local therapy, as it were, being in the room co-presently and working at a distance. Because only if we understand the differences can we actually use it in the way that it can be used. Certainly, it is fairly effective in bridging gaps of continuity if people are ill or have to work abroad for some period of time and then come back to the consulting room and work in person. It's very useful for people who are in areas where there is no treatment. It's better than nothing. Mm-hmm. Danger is to confuse better than nothing with an equivalent to working in the same room co-present. Mm-hmm. And I think this has real implications for the way we talk to our patients. For instance, in obtaining informed consent, unless we know what we're actually offering and the limitations of what we're offering, and our patients understand that, then I'm not sure that it's something that we can do and not think about. And also, in the setting of our fees, people tend to charge the same amount for working online as they do in the room. Big question mark there. Is that something we should be doing if mm-hmm. what we're offering is quite different?
Well, touching on an economic issue, you do point out that you suggest that part of the big rush to do online therapy are economic pressures one of the things maybe driving this?
Yes, absolutely. And it was something that was talked about time and time again by the people I interviewed. It allows someone to work with a very, very broad patient base. You're unlimited in the people that you can work with. It may allow some people who work exclusively online not to have any overheads for a consulting room.
Yes.
At the moment, there's a saturation of practitioners all over America and certainly the UK where I trained. And I think that if you can work online, that you can have a much larger practice.
Yes. Okay.
That's what I call the elephant in the room.
Yeah, the elephant. Yeah, that we
can't talk about, but that is very much there.
That's interesting because in the psychoanalytic relationship with one's patient, the issue of fees is something that often comes up and has to be talked about, and can be a difficult issue. And so it's interesting that pulling out into the larger arena of looking at the therapists and their lives, that there is this elephant in the room.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that it extends to trainings as well, because very problematically, 3 or 4 psychoanalytic institutes in the United States have decided that they are going to offer what they call full psychoanalytic training online to Chinese candidates. And that means that those candidates are getting full psychoanalysis, training psychoanalysis, all online. And I think that raises tremendous questions as to what's being offered. We all know that all institutes across the world are suffering from lack of applicants, candidates. And again, this is a way of extending the pool outwards without actually addressing the fact that if someone has their entire training analysis online, what does it mean when they start to work in the room with someone?
Hmm. And first China, but not far behind, will be the rest of the world, right?
Well, interesting enough, when I spoke with someone about this recently who was in a part of America that didn't have an institute, she said, oh gosh, maybe I can work with, the institute in Chicago because they're offering this. So you're quite right.
Yeah. I
was just going to say to you, when you said that you have these you can have these intense moments of rapport, I think they do exist. Mm-hmm. I think that the problem is that that sort of functional equivalence that we experience is not something that can be maintained throughout the experience of, for instance, a psychoanalytic hour. You have moments of it, but it isn't something that can be continuous. And I think also, and this is a really huge issue, what we experience as rapport or as something, I think Sherry Turkle told me she had someone she interviewed who said they experienced this as a quickening, something terribly exciting that was happening that was online. And I think that when you have those moments, the question is, what actually is happening? I think it can be quite deceptive. And just to tell you two bits of research, one bit of research, one of the only ones like this, was done short-term psychodynamic therapy with people experiencing chronic pain, half the group online, the other half face-to-face in the room. The face-to-face people had a much better result in the treatment and 12 months later as well. But both groups were equally satisfied with the treatment. In other words, both groups' experience was a positive one, although only one group really actually benefited from the treatment, the face-to-face one. So I think, you know, that makes us think, well, what is actually going on? Second bit of research, very interesting, done at UCLA. You remember I told you about the navigation neurons in the brain?
Yes, right.
Memory. Well, they've done some further research with rats in which the rats were put into an intensely immersive virtual environment. And what they found was that the rats who were in the virtual environment, those neurons began to fire randomly as if the rat had no idea where it was. And half of them shut down. However, and this is the key thing, the observers watching the rats in both situations, the real environment and the immersive environment, did not see any difference in the rats' behavior. The rats maneuvered in exactly the same way. And they were shocked that they saw no difference, but actually the brains showed a tremendous difference. So I guess if we're going to think about the way that people actually relate on a nonverbal level, on a sort of micro level, the way that we actually communicate with each other, what is being changed that we don't feel is being changed when we have these experiences? More research needs to be done.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Virtual reality is coming at us like a freight train. What impact do you think that will have on the issues that we've been discussing? Do you think it will ameliorate any of the concerns that you've raised?
Well, I don't know. I think that if we look at the research that the people who are trying to perfect virtual reality are doing, like that rat study, what we can understand is that we may experience something as real, but it may not be deeply affecting us on a sort of a neurological level in the way that it should be. And my take on what happens when you have a psychoanalytic relationship is that very profound changes take place on a neurological level because of the relationship, which is what happens when we're babies and as we grow in our relationships with people. So I think that in one way, virtual reality may solve some problems in terms of the feeling of presence, but in other ways, I'm not sure what it's going to do if it doesn't actually reach those very deep parts of us. And I just want to add, isn't it amazing that people really are so intent on substituting machines for humans? And why? What is this wish? You know, the brain in the vat, you know, if we can only have this bodiless ideal experience, you know?
That's a good question, and definitely...
That's my next book.
Yeah, fodder for another interview, I'm sure. Yeah, what is it? You mentioned Sherry Turkle, and I've wanted to interview her. She doesn't respond when I've tried to reach out to her. But her work certainly communicates that the issues that we're talking about go far beyond psychoanalysis, that really our whole lives seem to be more and more dominated by screens. Mm-hmm. And there's concern about that, fairly right. widespread concern about that.
Right. That's right. In fact, research has shown, I think they did this study with college students, that the capacity for empathy has dropped, 20-30%, something like that, in the last couple of decades. And, this idea that it's neat and that it's controllable and that it is bounded in order that you can text, that you can use a screen. There's no messy kind of mm-hmm. unpredictability in relationships. And, that's very attractive to all of us in some
yeah.
way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as you look into your crystal ball, where do you see all this going? You have any sense of where... What's your sense of where it's going
there
over the next 10 years?
There's a negative and there's a positive.
Uh-huh.
One crystal ball really shows us going down both for economic reasons and just for this mysterious internal desire to be free of the messiness of human relationships, down a very... technological path without actually looking at what we lose in the process. I think you interviewed someone else who was very interested in doing online counseling, and you asked him about, with his crystal ball, what would be the difference in 5 years' time? And he says something like, well, it wouldn't be called online counseling. It would simply be called counseling. Mm. That is terribly alarming because, again, are we going to confuse something that takes place in two dimensions, bounded by a screen, with something that happens, embodied in a shared environment so that we actually lose the distinction? So that's my negative crystal ball. My positive crystal ball, and I think with this along with Sherry Turkle, is that there are people, and in fact, many young people, who've grown up with technology, who actually have a tremendous longing for something much more authentic. And I know Todd Essig, who we mentioned before, writes for Forbes, and he mentioned the idea to some very young colleagues in journalists about doing online treatment, and their response was yuck. Hmm. That it was not something that they would want to do. I know when I was in the UK, another journalist I talked to, a young woman, said that she described it as the loneliest experience of her life, speaking with an analyst online. So my positive crystal ball would be that we'd be able to define what we need in order to do treatment and what we need in order to have relationships in general, so that we're aware of how to use technology in a creative way, in a helpful way, without actually depleting and lessening ourselves as human beings. So, there's a choice there, which crystal ball.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a beautiful wrap-up. Dr. Jillian Isaacs-Russell, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
I want to thank listener Carol Grimson for recommending I interview Jillian Isaacs-Russell. Carol wrote to me, "Hey Dave, I just listened to your podcast with Clay Cockrell. It was very informative, so thank you so much. Also, I'm wondering if you've seen the book Screen Relations by Jillian Isaacs-Russell. I thought it might be interesting to interview her as a possible follow-up to that interview. I think she makes some good points about what we might be needing to discuss as a community. Thanks, happily listening here in Japan," and that's from Carol. Well, I really appreciated that recommendation because I didn't know about Dr. Russell or her book, and I realized that it would be a perfect counterpoint to my interview with Clay Cockrell. One of Dr. Russell's complaints about Skype was that among various technical problems, it would sometimes freeze up. That's why I've moved away from Skype to a similar service by the name of Zoom, which I've generally found to be more reliable. However, as luck would have it, and perhaps to underscore Dr. Russell's point, our connection froze early in the interview. Fortunately, we were able to reestablish it, and I was able to edit it out so that you won't experience it. I think Dr. Russell has written another one of those tour de force books that will be a landmark publication on the limits of computer-mediated therapy. Quite simply, she has not only thought about it deeply and carefully interviewed others, both therapists and clients, about their experiences, but in her research, she has also ventured beyond psychoanalysis into neuroscience, communication studies, infant observation, cognitive science, human-computer interaction, and more. Furthermore, her book is replete with research citations. I stand in awe of her ability to integrate so much information from so many sources and perspectives. Despite the limitations of screen relations that she points out, I felt Dr. Russell and I had some real moments of contact, especially after continuing our chat after the formal interview was over. I recommend this book highly to any therapists who are already engaging in or considering engaging in cyber therapy. Of course, it will also be of interest to general listeners who are interested in the broader societal implications of screen relations on real-world relationships. As always, you're encouraged to purchase Screen Relations, The Limits of Computer-Mediated Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy by Jillian Isaacs Russell using the Amazon affiliate widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for a while, so I thought it was high time for me to make a donation for a couple of reasons. First of all, you've pointed me in the direction of some very interesting authors whose books I have bought and obviously paid for, so I figured it was only fair that you get a reward for your own work. And secondly, these long, in-depth interviews are sort of a niche format, produced almost exclusively by independent podcasters who rely on individual donations to cover their own costs. So I'd like to appeal to all your listeners to step up to the plate and make a donation. Thank you very much for all your good work.
Thank you, Michael Ginter, for that particularly timely call to action. It's been 2 or 3 weeks since I've announced a new donor, and yet I know there are thousands out there who are listening but who have never donated. Once again, there are no new donors since the last episode. So if you're not already a financial supporter, I do hope you'll join Michael as a donor. It's the right thing to do. Hey, if you're a health and wellness provider, such as a yoga therapist, naturopath, acupuncturist, life coach, chiropractor, midwife, or any other of a host of health and wellness providers, then it's a pretty safe bet that one of your top priorities is going to be growing your practice. That's where Swellbee.com comes in. They have created a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to list their services. When you add your business profile to their online site, new clients will be able to find you, as well as book and pay for services through this HIPAA-compliant site. It's simple and easy to use. It's Swellbee.com, and right now you can sign up to use the service for free. In other breaking news, my virtual friend Matthew Dolitz, the Australian founder slash editor slash publisher of the online magazine The Neuropsychotherapist, which you've heard me promote from time to time, has invited me to join in an advisory capacity his latest undertaking, which is NeuroRobotics Magazine. He knows I'm very interested in technology, and his magazine will cover developments in artificial intelligence, virtual reality, and robotics. So if you share my interest in these technologies and how they are likely to impact our lives, You can register to be part of the community right now at no cost by going to www.neurorobotics.com/register. And neurorobotics is spelled NEUROROBOTICS, all one word. Speaking of these technologies, I wonder if there might be a volunteer or two out there willing to transcribe two past episodes. I'm referring to number 489, The Promise of Technology for the Aging Brain with Dr. Adam Ghazali, and episode number 475, The Social and Psychological Impact of Artificial Intelligence and Robotics with John Markoff. In addition to making these transcripts available to our shrink wrap audience, I believe they would be likely to appear in the aforementioned Neurorobotics magazine. So let me know if you're interested in doing one or both of these transcriptions. Oh, and one other bit of news. I just updated to a new, better microphone for your listening enjoyment. Also, it's my techno geek expressing itself. I wonder if you can tell the difference in my voice between this episode and previous ones. I can't, unfortunately, but I'm hoping that has to do with my hearing challenges. I hope you can tell the difference. If you can't, maybe you have hearing problems too, or maybe I just got carried away by techno lust. Finally, we're coming into that gift-giving time of year again. If you end up buying gifts on Amazon.com, the everything store, please remember to use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com. You can use that widget to shop for more than just books. Using it, you can navigate to any section of the Amazon site, and your purchases will be tagged as coming from Shrink Wrap Radio. It's another way that you can help to support the show.
Hi, this is Dr. Gillian Isaacs-Russell, psychoanalyst and author of Screen Relations, The Limits of Computer-Mediated Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Gillian Isaacs-Russell, whom we heard from earlier during the interview. This is the point in the show where I typically read email from our listener community. Without reading them here, I can tell you that I did hear from two people who were quite critical of my closing commentary on the last episode, in which I interviewed listener Jane Hart about her experience of dissociative identity disorder. A big part of her motivation for bravely sharing her experience with multiple personalities was to counter the message from films and other media that portray the disorder in a lurid, sensationalistic way. It was certainly my intent as well to support her in that goal. Unfortunately, I said something really dumb in my commentary after her interview. I mentioned that I had co-authored a book about an infamous serial killer whom I hypothesized in the book may have suffered from multiple personalities, and I also suggested people could buy my book. I now am keenly aware that may have had the effect of undercutting the message Jane was so courageously giving voice to. I deeply regret my unfortunate utterance and apologize to Jane and any others who may have been shocked by what I said. I made a poor judgment call. By the way, it was episode 531 that I've been talking about, and I did go back and edit those remarks out of the recording so that anyone who hasn't listened to that episode yet won't hear them. I discuss this in somewhat greater detail in the upcoming December newsletter. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can use our message phone or our app. Our message phone is 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Gillian Isaacs-Russell, for sharing her finely tuned reflections on cybertherapy. My next interview will be with return guest Daniel J. Siegel, MD, who has a new 2016 book titled Mind, A Journey to the Heart of Being Human. He was previously my guest back in 2011, speaking about his book Mindsight. So I know we've got something great to look forward to. So I hope you will join us then. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.